Now, multi-frame averaging is something we discussed, and in confocal microscopy, it is quite common, and there are several applications of imaging where multi-frame imaging is very commonly used, as long as your specimen is held fixed. So in microscopy applications, where you have a particular biological specimen or some specimen, it is fixed, and you have some time to take images. Some imaging procedures could cause some damage to the specimen if it is repeatedly imaged. When I take a picture of you using natural ambient light, you wouldn't complain. But if I put flash on you repeatedly, you won't be damaged, but you will complain. There are many artists and musicians who would not like flash to be used while they are performing, so it irritates or annoys them. But there are some imaging procedures where if you're using a laser to scan the specimen, or if you're using an electron beam to scan the specimen is actually heated and could be damaged in the process of acquiring the image. Of course, when you are subjected to X-ray imaging, there is a small amount of damage caused. Even ultrasound will make your tissue behave in a certain way during exposure to ultrasound, because ultrasound is vibratory sound energy, and your tissues will respond to that energy that is deposited in your body. There could be local heating caused. There is some local vibration at a very high frequency. So you will essentially be rattled by the ultrasound that is used to probe you for a few milliseconds, or could be for a few seconds or even minutes. But you don't feel it because of the frequency. Whereas if it is very low frequency, you would feel your body or tissues vibrating. In the case of ultrasound, it is presumed that there is no harmful effect at the energy and frequency used for medical imaging. It is said that there is no known or established harmful effect, which doesn't mean that it is harmless, that nobody knows yet if there is a harmful effect of ultrasound. On the other hand, for X-rays, it is well known and established that there is a harmful effect due to the ionizing property of the radiation. Now, coming back to this modality of imaging, in confocal microscopy, what you use is a laser beam to scan finely focused planes of fluorescent dye-tagged specimens that could be a few millimeters in thickness. So you have a biological specimen, some tissue, that is tagged with a fluorescent dye that will fluoresce in a particular color when investigated with a laser beam of a certain frequency. So the laser beam is used to scan the specimen, and the dye that is put in will be sensitive to, or will get tagged with, certain parts of the tissue, and then will emit certain type of light in response to the stimulation by the laser beam. Now, because a coherent light source is used, this obviates the blur caused in imaging using ordinary light microscopy, where different frequencies of incident light will be used, using white light or any other artificial light source. I mentioned earlier in the first chapter that in light microscopy there are a number of problems that affect the number of limitations that affect image quality. In confocal microscopy, by using coherent light, this laser beam, light of one specific frequency, you overcome that problem. Now, laser excitation causes the dye, that is, or dye or purple dyes, to emit light at particular wavelengths, that is, they fluoresce and give light. So multiple dyes could be used to separate various tissue components or different types of tissue in the sample. The confocal microscope uses a pinhole to permit the passage of only the light from a particular focal plane. So the specimen could be a few millimeters thick, not that thick, but a few millimeters thick. And you can take fine planes to be in focus, you can make them to be in focus and the rest to be blurred. So by stacking those, it is possible to get an estimate of a three-dimensional image of various sections. So you get light from a particular plane in focus, and the light from other planes will be out of focus or blocked by the pinhole. A photomultiplier tube, or PMT, is used to amplify the light that comes out, because it's fairly weak light, and that is amplified, and then a scanning mechanism is used to scan the sample in small steps that could be 0.1 micrometer. So you scan, only that part of the tissue is excited, and then you scan and take the picture out. The confocal microscope facilitates the imaging of multiple focal planes separated by about 1 micrometer within a sample that could be a few millimeters, a couple of millimeters thick. So you can get several planes with a resolution of 1 micrometer, and you can stack them up and make a 3D image if you want. So here are some examples. The laser beam used is 488 nanometers. There is a dye that gives a red signal out, red light out, at 585 nanometers. And these are the nuclei of the cells there. And these are from the nucleus pulposus of a dog from the intervertebral discs. There's a green dye that gives light in this band, 505 to 530 nanometers. And that corresponds to the actin filament structure in these samples. The thickness of the focal plane is about 1 micrometer. And multi-frame averaging or synchronized averaging was used to acquire these images. This image is good on my screen, but not there. Let me see if zooming helps. Otherwise, we may have to shut down the lights for a little while. If I make the picture bigger, it may be a little more clear. Maybe if you can turn off these lights at the front, please. So anyway, this is the red component where you see the cells, and a little bit in the background. This is the green part where you see the filament structure, the actin filament structure. And then you can combine them and make a composite image. In the book, they are in black and white, in grayscale. But these are the original images. So here you can put them together and make a composite image of that particular slice or focal plane of that sample. Let me see if I can retain this magnification. And okay, these were acquired by averaging 8 frames. So the specimen was scanned 8 times. And it's not taking one snapshot. Remember, the specimen is scanned with a laser beam running across like that. So it takes some time. And the laser beam, when it scans the specimen, deposits a certain amount of energy on the specimen. And that could cause some local heating and damage. And the fluorescent dye that is put into the object, into the specimen, it can fluoresce only so many times when triggered by the incident laser beam. After some time, that fluorescent capability is lost. So you cannot scan a given specimen more than a few times. And after that, you will not get the same data. So when we say that we are scanning this and getting 8 frames, and we are assuming that the object is the same to average, and the only difference is the noise, that is true only for a small number of passes of this imaging technique. If you do it 50 times, there will be a change in the object characteristics. If you do 100 times, then certainly there is significant difference. So there is a limit to the number of times you can capture an image of this type for averaging. So when I said there are other modes that can cause damage, there is a similar implication in other situations too, such as in electron microscopy. You have an electron beam that is running through the object, and it is being absorbed and attenuated. So there is energy being absorbed by the tissue sample or whatever it is you are scanning. When energy is absorbed by something, there is a local change, heating, whatever. Something happens. So here are some examples of processing, just to show you the type of noise you have. So here are 2 frames, and averaging using different numbers of frames. The details are in the caption. I'll have to read that in a moment. By averaging 8 frames and 4 and 8 frames. Okay. So we, for this experiment, we acquired two frames without averaging. So this is one frame, this is another frame, the noise is different, but these were acquired successively, so there shouldn't be any big change in the sample. So we then averaged a number of them. This is averaging 4 and this is averaging 8. So the noise, if you look at some of these portions, the noise has been reduced just by averaging. And averaging 8 frames has led to a significant reduction in noise. There could be other variations here. It's hard to say if that is noise or inherent texture or inherent variation in the object. Could be something that is true to the object. But the background clearly indicates reduction in noise by averaging. If you average a few more frames, you will get better results. But this is using 8 and this is using 4 frames for averaging. Now, if you only had one frame, for some reason you could only scan once, then you cannot do multi-frame averaging. Then this is simply to show that you could apply the 3x3 mean, median, and 5x5 mean filter and 5x5 median to one frame. And obviously, from the examples I've shown so far, I won't zoom and so on, you could compare in the book. But even if you cannot see any significant distortion here, from the test images I have shown you, you know that the 3x3 mean and median filters cause blurring and noise, blurring and shape distortion. So they would be inherent here. So you either scan the sample a number of times and average those frames, or you take one frame and then filter using these methods and pay the price of some other distortion. You could compare these to the others and judge for yourself the difference in quality. And we also tried the 5x5 LLMMSE filter, the refined LLMMSE filter, the repeated Wiener filter, and our adaptive filter, just to show you how these filters behave with a real-life image with no synthetic noise added, but the noise is part of the imaging process. And you could compare them if you wish. If you apply a Fourier domain method, here is the Fourier spectrum, and then a result of ideal low-pass filtering and Butterworth low-pass filtering. Again, you cannot really see directly much difference, but the advantage of the test images, the phantom images I used and showed you earlier, would be to visualize the kind of artifacts that each method produces. That is why I use the shapes test image with the triangles and so on. So we know what kind of a distortion or undesirable effect each method has. The ideal filter, ideal low-pass filter, will cause ringing artifacts. The ringing artifacts are there, but we can't really perceive that easily. Let me zoom a lot and let's see if we can see that. I'll zoom 300 times. 300% opposed. So this is the original, fairly sharp edges, noisy. And this is the ideal filter. You can see a little bit of ringing artifact, but it's not so obvious. It's like a ghost image there. Let's go back to the original. Can we see that? No, there is no ghost there. Whereas here you see that ghost image. So it is there. If you just look at the printed version and pass in a few seconds, you not notice it. But an expert in the area, if you were to process a mammogram with this image and take it to an radiologist, he or she will immediately throw it back and say, no, this is not, there is something wrong. That expert may not be able to say that it is ringing artifact, but will not like the image because that person knows the characteristics of the image and will say that the processed image is worse than the original. A radiologist, in particular in nuclear medicine, will tolerate a high amount of noise and would like to edges as sharp as can be, but will tolerate blurring of edges, even if that means noise is reduced. So that is one of the observations I have made during my years of collaboration with medical specialists. There are some things they will tolerate and some things that they will not tolerate. So in filtering images and modifying them and giving them back to the expert, you have to recognize what that expert in that particular domain will tolerate and will not tolerate. And what is the price that person will pay and will not pay. This is the last one, and then we will take a break. So noise reduction in nuclear medicine imaging. I mentioned earlier that in gated nucleus in imaging, for the imaging of the heart, you could use a certain technique of photon counting within intervals. Background to that is nuclear medicine images, rather, are typically acquired under low photon conditions. That is, you don't want to put too much of the radioactive material into the patient. And the counting period is typically limited to a few minutes or a few seconds, typically a few minutes. And even then, you're only detecting a small fraction of the gamma ray photons that are emitted from the patient because of the efficiency of detection in the Anger camera. So you have a significant amount of Poisson noise that is present in nuclear medicine images. The counting of photons over long periods of time will reduce the effect of noise and give you a good quality image, but counting over long periods will mean that you will be introducing or including artifacts due to motion, and there are some practical limits too as to how long you can keep a patient in that machine, and there could be a lineup of other patients coming in that will have economic implications and service implications. So practical considerations will say you cannot sit counting photons there for minutes on end, but you have to do that within a certain practically feasible period. So here is an example of a phantom image. The phantom looks like this, the last image D. Oh, something happened here, the D has jumped. Okay, is that like that in the book? Okay, we didn't fix it. Oh, I think the size of this image is something different. Anyway, the phantom is a plexiglass drum or cylinder, and inside that there are holes drilled, and the holes are filled with the radioactive material. So these bright areas you see are holes in a plastic cylinder, and that whole cylinder is put in another plastic cylinder that has the liquid, and that's why you see a ring around it which has the radioactive material. So the bright area here indicates the presence of radioactive material when this, it's a physical phantom. So it's a real object, but it is not a patient. So there are these holes that become smaller and smaller as you go along this axis. I don't remember the dimensions, but I think I have given that in the book, in the chapter on image reconstruction. Or maybe it is described in the text there. So if you were to fill this is a cross-section of the phantom. It's a three-dimensional physical tub with this plastic or plexiglass object and the holes. So if you were to take a 128 by 128 pixel SPECT image, this is a cross-section using single photon emission computer tomography. The counting of photons was done over 2 seconds to get this image, the first one. The second one over 15 seconds, and the third one over 40 seconds per projection, if I remember right. I'll have to read that section carefully. I'm pretty sure this is per projection. And then the cross-section is reconstructed from the projections. So as you can see, if you reduce your photon counting interval or projection data acquisition period, you get a terribly noisy image, and you cannot resolve the smaller objects here. And as you increase the counting time, the smaller objects become more and more, have better and better contrast and more visible. But still, the smallest object, the two small holes there at the end, are not visible. That's the limiting resolution of the system. These holes are very small. I can't remember the size. It must be in the book somewhere. So that is how you can improve the quality of an image in nuclear medicine imaging. But in gated blood pool imaging of the heart, you cannot increase the data acquisition time to several seconds per projection image because the heart will have gone through several contraction and expansion cycles, so systole and diastole cycles. So here are projection images that are obtained by gating the projection data with the ECG. And these are not SPECT, these are just planar nuclear medicine images. They are projection images of the patient, and by taking one row per image, you get per projection image, you can get the reconstruction in 3D, one slice at a time. So these are planar projection images. And what is done is this. Along with the counting of the photons, you take the ECG of the patient, which has these waves, P, Q, R, S, T, and another cycle. I'm showing two cycles of the heartbeat. And you need an algorithm to detect a particular point within each cardiac cycle. And there are algorithms to detect the QRS wave within each beat. And we studied that in the course last year. Once you detect one particular point, with reference to that point, you break the cardiac cycle into a number of intervals, how many ever you want. Let us say 8. So this is the initialization of the contraction. Another part, next part, next, 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 and next, and then that is the initialization of the next phase. And then what you do is you break your data into 8 pieces or 8 planes, and for the contraction part, the data will go into this phase I labeled as 4, and the next one will go into 5, and the next so many milliseconds. You have to assume a certain heart, you don't have to assume the heart rate, you know the heart rate from the patient. And then you just break the interval between the QRS beats on the average into so many parts. And the photons that are emitted from the patient during this interval will go into that image, the next interval into that image, and the next to that image, and so on. And when you come to the next beat, in the same cardiac cycle, the QRS complex there, that will go into the same phase, 4, into which the other image went. So for each phase of the cardiac cycle, the data will go to the same phase image. So the cardiac cycle is broken into 8 images in this case, and you may image the patient for a few minutes and break each cardiac cycle into the same phases because it is periodic or rhythmic, let's say. It doesn't have to be exactly the same period, beat to beat. It will not be the same. And also, in between, if the patient has some abnormal beat, such as an ectopic beat, if you can build an algorithm to detect ectopic beats, such as premature ventricular contractions, because it is an abnormal beat and the blood hasn't gone through or the heart hasn't gone through the same cycle, you reject the data for that beat. You do not include the data for such a beat and then wait for the next correct normal beat and include those counts and so on. So this way you gate the data, or you divide the data into parts and gate them, and that's why it's called gated blood pool imaging. And you get images of this type where you see the left ventricle here, that bright part. You see the thyroid and parathyroid glands of the patient. That's the heart. You're interested in the ventricle. It's becoming smaller and smaller and smaller. So that is systole. So this is the end of systole, or contraction of the heart, in particular the ventricles. The left ventricle is the smallest here. And then it expands, and then back to that. So I don't remember, let's see. Each image is 64 by 64 pixels. And we use 6 phases of the cardiac cycle. In the other image, I showed 8. I should have made it 6. And this was averaged over 16 cardiac cycles. So it's like averaging over 16 frames of each phase of the cardiac cycle. And the images are still noisy, but these are better than one frame. And I could not get one frame. The system does not give one frame out. So many of these practical clinical systems don't allow users to fiddle around with the software for good reason, because they have a warranty and other implications. So we could not get single frame data. These are averaged over 16 cardiac cycles. Whereas with the confocal microscope, we could get one frame out. Okay, that's the end of chapter 3. It's 3:40, so let's take a break and please come back at 3.